Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The first international Long COVID Awareness Day was this past March. It was a day in which advocates from all over the world united for better recognition of something called long COVID. Vaccines have been produced, the pandemic is officially over, but millions of people are still suffering long after infection. And the purpose of this hour is to understand exactly what long COVID is, who it affects, how it impacts those who suffer from it, and what, if anything, you can do to prevent getting it. To help us through this, we've invited Dr. Stephanie Sutherland to join us. She is a neuroscientist and science journalist who recently wrote about long COVID for Scientific American. Dr. Sutherland, welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Dr. Coro Giovacchini, or Giovacchini, help me out here, doctor. I just forgot how to say your name. I'm sorry.
Giovacchini. Giovacchini.
Like the vegetable. Dr. Coral Giovacchini is an assistant professor of medicine at Duke University School of Medicine and a critical care specialist and pulmonologist with Duke Health. Thank you for enduring my mispronunciation and welcome.
That's fine. Thank you for having me.
And in this first part of the program, we're going to hear directly from someone suffering from long COVID, Amanda Stauffer. She is a writer and architectural restorer in Boston who has experienced a particularly brutal constellation of long COVID symptoms, despite the fact that she is young and healthy. I know this takes a lot of effort on your part, and you're in fact waiting to go into your doctor's appointment. So thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
I want to spend a good portion of this first segment with Amanda talking about how this has impacted you personally. But before we do, because you have to leave early, I'm going to take you first. But before we get to that, Dr. Sutherland, give me a good definition of exactly what we're talking about. How would you define long COVID?
So it's tricky. This is, of course, a new disease, and it has just kind of emerged as people emerged with symptoms over the last 3 years. As you know, we started the pandemic just about 3 years ago. The World Health Organization defines long COVID, which is also called post-acute sequelae of COVID-19, as symptoms that last 2-3 months past the initial acute infection. And some people develop it after they have, quote unquote, gotten better, and then symptoms kind of resurface, and other people just never really get better. Patient-led groups and various publications have compiled over 200 different symptoms that can arise with long COVID. And everyone is different. As you said, there's a constellation of symptoms, and some people will have more neurological type symptoms, which is what I wrote about in my piece. Other people are recovering from damage to their lungs or other organs. It really runs the gamut.
Amanda, you contracted, as I understand it, you got COVID in November of 2022. Describe your life, if you would, prior to getting COVID.
Yeah, I mean, I was very active, running, hiking, skiing, paddleboarding, parenting, working, and it has just, the life as I knew it is gone, at least for now. It stopped all of that. I have a couple different things going on with long COVID, but the major one is I have POTS, which stands for postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. Which basically means anytime that I'm vertical, like the orthostatic part, my heart my heart rate skyrockets, and it can make me faint. It gets me really short of breath, stabbing chest pain. And so I have been effectively bedbound since November. I have a wheelchair, but don't get out much anyway. I'm very lucky that my work was already remote, so I just work from bed now, and it's a very, very different existence and kind of a depressing one.
You had no, as I understand it, you had no underlying conditions prior to catching COVID that would make you, because we know that a lot of people who have gotten COVID had underlying comorbidities. You did not. Is that correct?
No, Nope, I had none. And at least in the clinic that I'm at, that seems to fit the profile of a lot of the POTS patients. They're women between like 25 to 50. There were, most of the patients were very active before. And they don't know, like, one of the theories right now is that it has to do with having had really good cardiac tone and that your heart somehow isn't responding correctly when you get COVID. But I also had all my vaccinations. I got the bivalent booster in September. Didn't stop any of this.
Dr. Giovacchini, we know that getting vaccinated is still the best defense against getting COVID, but does getting vaccinated, because Amanda was vaccinated, does it help you in any way from getting long COVID?
Oh, it's a very interesting question. So we know that it does prevent you from getting severe COVID illness. There are some studies that suggest that vaccination does decrease the rates of long COVID overall. Some of the things that we'll get to later, I'm sure, as we're talking about this, is that a lot of the long COVID patients, as Amanda mentioned, are not the ones who had severe disease. And the risk factors that we think of as those that predispose you to severe disease are not necessarily the ones that predispose you to having long COVID. And so it's a little bit of a confusing picture. One thing that potentially does help and might explain some of the reduced rates of long COVID with vaccination is that something that's playing out is that we see that the number of symptoms you had with your initial COVID illness, sort of the range of symptoms, might predispose you to having long COVID in the future. And so in theory, getting vaccinated may reduce the number of symptoms overall, and that might reduce your risk of long COVID, but it's really something that we're still teasing out. Certainly everybody would still advocate that you get vaccinated to reduce your risk of severe disease, but it's something to kind of be seen in the future for long COVID.
So Amanda, you got vaccinated, you had all the boosters. What were your initial symptoms of COVID that might tie into this long COVID situation that you find yourself in?
So mine was incredibly mild. My family has been pretty rigorous all along about testing, and you know, the home tests are only so accurate, but we had all tested earlier that week and we were all negative. And then maybe like 5 days after that test, I started having chest pain, and that was it. And not like debilitating chest pain, just I've never had chest pain in my life before. I thought it was kind of strange. And very coincidentally, my sister, who doesn't live anywhere near me, lives in New York. She tested positive for COVID and called me sort of in a panic. And while we were on the phone, I said like, oh, I've been having this chest pain. I wonder if I should just take a test. And I took a test and it was positive and called my doctor. And my doctor said, you know, normally, like, if you didn't have COVID, we'd say you can wait a little while, but COVID, chest pain, like not a great thing to go in combination. So go to the ER, get an EKG, get them just to check it out, just rule out a clot or anything major. So I went, I actually honestly felt fine, minus this minor chest pain. All my tests checked out. They sent me home and said, you know, we're really glad that you don't have a clot or anything, you know, life-threatening, but if it doesn't go away, come back in 2 weeks. I tried not to be a hypochondriac. I went back in 3 weeks. I still had that chest pain. And then I failed a couple tests they gave me, pulmonary function tests, the standard walking test. My oxygenation dropped from 100 to 91 walking like for 30 seconds. And 91 is a pretty low bar. That's when if you had COVID, they'd say, oh, you can go to the ER now if your oxygenation is so bad. And so then that sort of kicked off the whole investigation into my long COVID. And then the symptoms started getting worse. Like then POTS kicked in and then I couldn't stand up and walk. But it really all just started from a really mild case of COVID that I barely would have picked up. You know, it didn't even occur to us that I was sick.
So again, POTS is postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome.
Yes, correct.
And in you, at least, it presents that when you stand up, if you're vertical for any period of time, it's almost impossible for you. And then again, if you sit for extended periods of time, I'm told that blood can pool in your legs and you faint.
Yeah, so exactly.
How do you spend most of your time?
Well, there are a couple sort of standard supportive treatments that they have you do, I think, across the board for POTS patients now. And I wear compression garments, like medical compression gear from toe to sternum. So I have like a corset and compression leggings and socks. And then the main way that they have you sort of deal with it is you up your salt intake tremendously. So like the average person probably is supposed to get, I think it maxes out at 2 grams a day. The doctors can weigh in here. But for me, they have me taking 10 grams a day. And the goal of that is that your blood pressure goes up and then that drives your heart rate down so that it's tolerable. Like it's a very, like it's sort of, you're tricking your heart into thinking that you can at least function and breathe and not have chest pain all the time and not wheeze to catch air. But I still can't, even with all the salt and all the compression garments and all the supplements they have me taking, I max out around 5 minutes of standing.
Wow. You also in recent months have been diagnosed with additional conditions, neuropathy.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I can even say this. Erythromelalgia. Is that close?
Erythromelalgia.
Okay. I mistyped it.
That's a good effort.
And something called slipping rib syndrome. Take us through those various different conditions and how they impact you.
So I'll take them one at a time. What was the first one you said? Oh, the neuropathy. So part of the issue with that they think, at least with COVID-mediated POTS, is that it's a vascular issue about like circulating your blood properly throughout your system. And mine just isn't doing that right now. And so the blood, the same way it pools in my legs and can make me faint, sort of gathers in my extremities, like hands and feet. And so there's two different things that happen for me. The neuropathy causes them to just go completely numb. It's one of the reasons that I'm not really driving anymore, because I just lose sensation of my feet for hours a day. It's not painful. You just can't feel them. But then the flip of that is the erythromelalgia, sort of my nerves firing on my hands and feet. And so it's like intense itching and burning. And that one's much less comfortable. And then the slipping rib is newer for me. I developed it about 3 or 4 weeks ago. And what happened was I don't do a lot since I can't move. And so just by breathing one day, I heard a pop and my rib dislocated. And the theory right now is that I have this thing called slipping rib syndrome, which means that my ligaments and joints can just spontaneously dislocate because POTS falls under this umbrella of dysautonomia. So it's dysfunction of your autonomic nervous system. And my understanding, or as it's been explained to me, is that my nervous system, in addition to not doing a great job of telling my lungs when to catch air and breathe, is also not holding all my ligaments and joints together properly. So I just got over, like, I'm in the process of getting over a dislocated rib that was excruciatingly painful. And it feels really good to almost be done with it. But then there's this fear that if it just happened from breathing, it'll just happen again. And that is almost more debilitating than the other, because it's harder to talk through and harder to function through that level of pain.
I'm going to talk with the doctors about this in the next segment, but how do we know that all of these various things that are cropping up in you are the result of COVID? Could they have happened in the absence of COVID?
Yeah, that is a very good question. I have a really good team of doctors. I'm at a long COVID survivorship clinic at Beth Israel Deaconess here in Boston, and they're seeing thousands of patients like me. And I think the way that they sort of start to connect some of these dots is by seeing the same presentation in patients over and over again. So for example, like their erythromelalgia, I didn't know how to describe it. I said, you know, like have this burning sensation and it keeps me up at night I don't know how to knock it down. And he said, oh, I think I know. I think it's erythromelalgia, not usually part of my domain. He's a pulmonologist, the director of the clinic, but he's used to seeing it now with so many patients. It's, you know, as they were saying before, there's this like sequelae or constellation of 200 symptoms, they sort of start to piece together. Like you fall into this bucket, which also has these potential like corresponding issues.
Amanda Stauffer suffers from long COVID. I have one more question for you, and I want to ask it when we come back, and then I'll let you go because I know you have to go to a doctor's appointment. We're also joined by two doctors who deal with long COVID on a regular basis, and we'll talk to them and get into the weeds of what this is and how it presents and maybe what you can do to prevent getting it yourself, if anything. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about long COVID. We have two medical experts with us to join us in a second. We spent the first part of this program talking with a sufferer of long COVID, a writer and architectural restorer in Boston, Amanda Stauffer. who has a litany of conditions that have presented themselves because of a very mild case of actual COVID at the onset of all this. This came on in November 2022. I'm just curious about what doctors have told you about your prognosis, both for restoring your health and for what additional conditions might present before this is all in your rearview mirror, Amanda.
Yeah, so the biggest problem right now is that there is no treatment. You know, everything that I'm doing is considered supportive treatment, not medical. And this is at, you know, a great hospital. They just don't have any right now. And so the prognosis could, I mean, it sort of depends on how you want to see it. It could be very bleak. There are patients like me who caught it in, you know, March of 2020 who are still bedbound. And that could definitely be my fate as well. I'm hoping it won't be. But the other, you know, the other main tool that we have, at least for my, you know, condition, which doesn't apply to everybody with long COVID, but for POTS specifically, there's a cardiac rehab program out of the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia that physical therapy, it's very regimented. You do every single day for 8 months is accounted for, and they're all different in terms of reclining and recumbent exercises. So recumbent biking and strength training on the floor, lying down. And if everything progresses the way that it has so far for me, the goal is that I could maybe be walking by the late summer, early fall. But then again, you're sort of back in, the best understanding of it is that right now it's a remission relapse cycle. So as well as I could do, what I've been told by all of my doctors is that anything viral that I catch again, let alone COVID, but even like the common cold coming home through my kid, could just reignite the entire POTS sort of phenomenon again, so with all of the correlating symptoms.
As you sit here talking about this, it sounds, you sound very calm, very logical, very you're settled in with this, but you're a young woman. You were completely healthy before this all began. You were a runner, a skier, a hiker, a kayaker. You have a child. I think she's 7 years old. How do you deal with this mentally? How do you deal with this to balance your parenting responsibilities if you can't stand up for more than just a few moments at a time? How do you deal with it?
Yeah, well, I'm not able to do any of those sort of normal parenting things anymore. And so, you know, I'm lucky, like my husband has carried a lot of slack. We have five different neighbors who pick my kid up from school each one day a week. We have people coming over, bringing food, like that kind of thing. We've been really lucky. I know that everyone is not that lucky, but that's sort of how we're cobbling together a plan to get through. I think I'm more fortunate than most in that respect. And in terms of dealing with it mentally, it's tricky, you know. It's like I think we all go through cycles or waves with it. And for me, I feel like I've sort of found a level of just keeping my head down, doing this cardiac rehab, taking every single supplement that, you know, comes up in a new, our clinic was following all of the other research, and they'll say, oh, we see that there's some result if you take resveratrol and CoQ10. So I order them that day and I start taking them, and I'm sort of doing the best I can, thinking that there might be a remission period in sight. Obviously that could change. And each time that new symptoms crop up, like the painful ones, like the erythromelalgia, the slipping rib, it's depressing for a week or so until you say, okay, this is just life. I have to, you know, keep going on and adapt to it. But it's certainly not the way I expected, you know, living out the rest of my life.
Well, I salute your stiff upper lipness, if that's the right phrase, because it's amazing what you're going through, and I wish you the very best. I hope that this is in your rearview mirror very, very shortly. Amanda Stauffer, thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Also with us today is Dr. Stephanie Sutherland. She's a neuroscientist and science journalist. She wrote an article that you can still see in Scientific American. It's this month's issue, The Brain and Long COVID. Dr. Coral Giovacchini is with us, assistant professor of medicine at Duke University School of Medicine and a critical care specialist at Duke Health. Dr. Giovacchini, according to one source, between 5% and 80% of people who survive COVID-19 have long COVID symptoms. They may be very different from what Amanda is suffering from. And according to Dr. Sutherland's article in Scientific American, about 16 million U.S. adults suffer from this. If you agree with those numbers, why aren't we hearing more about this? This seems to be relatively quiet. It's a lot of people.
Yeah, it is a lot of people. And, you know, I think Dr. Sutherland will probably agree. Some of these numbers are very confusing and confounded because we for a long time didn't have a great definition of what this was. We weren't even aware of it, honestly, at the start of the pandemic. I think a lot of the focus, and rightly so early on, was on the acute COVID symptoms, the pandemic, the acute illness, and making sure we could, as a healthcare system, accommodate that and then get patients through the acute phase. I think we didn't really also start to hear about it because you expect a certain amount of recovery that might happen after an acute critical illness, and that can take months of time and can sort of present similarly and maybe mask some of the symptoms of have us misinterpret some of the symptoms of what long COVID is. And I think it's becoming more and more common to have these patients present now that we're in, you know, this is year three, now that we're coming up on COVID infections. And so now we're seeing these folks who have had persistent symptoms and recognizing with a little bit better of a definition what this is. I would say, you know, that range up to 80%, there are really variable numbers out there. I think clinically, and I do think Dr. Sutherland also points this out in her article, it's probably more in the range of 10 to 20% that we ultimately are seeing fall out. And it just, there was a lot of regional variation and some differences with different strains of COVID that we've seen with long COVID presentation.
In addition to Amanda, who we just spent 20 minutes talking to, we were made aware of a local author and physician who is also a long COVID sufferer who could not be with us today, but her symptoms are not unlike Amanda's, but also she can't expand her lungs. She says she feels like she can't take deep breaths, and she has recurring rashes on her toes and feet, and her sense of smell, which I want to talk about, has been distorted. Are all these symptoms common? Does everybody present with a different set of symptoms?
The short answer is yes to both of those things. Like, it's a very challenging thing to define. As you pointed out earlier in the segment, there are over 200 defined symptoms, and patients can have various clusters of these symptoms. Some of them kind of come together in terms of more autoimmune-driven symptoms or neurologic-related symptoms or pulmonary or cardiac symptoms, which can have a lot of crossover also with autoimmune and neuropathic effects. But yes, everybody, unfortunately, has a little bit different constellation in their symptoms, and it is unfortunately common with long COVID to have a variety of these.
So, Dr. Sutherland, you begin your article in Scientific American writing about a young woman not unlike Amanda, who was also an overachiever, but she still got COVID. And now 3 years later, she is still suffering from COVID. She has long COVID. Do scientists have any idea how long is?
Yeah, it's a great question. And as Amanda was saying, that's, I think, one of the hardest things for patients to deal with is that you just don't really have an idea of how long it might last. What I was hearing from some of the doctors in the clinics at UC Los Angeles here and other places is that, you know, some people have seemed to get better over a few months. Some people might have it for a year and then get better. Other people will get better and then maybe have a flare up where they feel worse again, or they might have a common symptom, or, you know, for many people is called post-exertional malaise, where they'll have kind of an energy crash after overdoing it, whether it's physically or mentally. But the people like Tara, who I talked about in my piece, you know, she got sick in March of 2020, and she is still very much suffering today. So there's a smaller number of people, but definitely still a very sizable number of people who are suffering with kind of no end in sight for years.
And yet not everybody suffers for years. And I'm also curious as to when long COVID becomes officially long COVID. How long do you have to present with symptoms before physicians will say, you got long COVID, Stephanie?
Yeah, I think, again, the World Health Organization puts it, it's a little, there are a couple different official definitions from different organizations, but basically, if you still have symptoms 3 months after you got sick, and those symptoms have lasted for at least 2 months, so it's somewhere in the 2 to 3 months range that we know that this is no longer an acute case of COVID-19.
And Dr. Giovacchini, a lot of these conditions that present in some of these patients who have gotten COVID are conditions that could present, the possibility is there, without having a COVID infection. So how do physicians diagnose this? How do they know that it's connected to COVID? Simply because the patients had it?
I certainly think there is that anchoring time point. I consider a very large part of my job in seeing these patients to rule out other things. And an important part of that definition across all organizations where we've been defining this is that there are those symptoms that have been, are consistent with this constellation and have been persistent for several months, but also cannot be explained by something else. And that also, I think, gets back to some of your question of why does this take so long to diagnose, or why are we just hearing about it now? And it's because we put patients through a pretty rigorous workup for the rest of their symptoms. You mentioned the patient with a feeling that she just can't breathe. She can't expand her lungs. She can't get the air out. And so there are other diagnoses that we have to run through to make sure that we're not missing something else and that there's not something else to treat. And to be fair, a lot of the long COVID symptoms or the constellation of these things, we have names for other illnesses. There are a lot of other viral illnesses that can also present, for example, with what we call post-viral reactive airways disease or an asthma-like syndrome that we do know how to treat. And so we treat those things and make sure that we're treating the rest of the diagnoses that we can name. We may still give you a diagnosis of long COVID when you have multiple symptoms that fall under this cluster. But a big part of what we do is to make sure that we can rule out everything else and treat everything else that we can name before we give you a long COVID diagnosis.
We spoke several years ago many times on this program, and just in the general zeitgeist, with all this conversation about chronic fatigue syndrome, and some people didn't think it was real, and it was very difficult to diagnose because you didn't know exactly what was going on. Is this kind of like that, Dr. Giovacchini? Unmute yourself.
Yes, it is somewhat like that. I'm hopeful that we are going to, so the NIH has now launched a lot of funding in the RECOVER initiative. There are some ongoing trials for both diagnostic and therapeutic purposes moving forward. And I'm hopeful now that as the medical community kind of gets a better definition for what this is and a more organized structure in terms of looking at this moving forward, that we're going to have a better understanding of what this truly is. But yes, as of right now, a lot of that is in this sort of nebulous phase of post-viral syndrome. And I would say that long COVID, it is considered kind of a post-viral syndrome to some degree, right? There are components of chronic fatigue syndrome, post-viral syndrome, and there's also acute illness recovery syndrome that can happen after you get out of an ICU, all of which can be kind of a part of this cluster. And again, that's why we need to really evaluate everything and make sure that we're treating the symptoms as best we can supportively while we work through what long COVID actually is.
And Dr. Sutherland, you write in your article that there is a strong resemblance between some aspects of long COVID and chronic fatigue syndrome. Could long COVID trigger chronic fatigue syndrome?
Yeah, I think for many people that much is clear. As I mentioned, that symptom called post-exertional malaise is kind of a hallmark of chronic fatigue syndrome, which is also called myalgic encephalomyelitis, MECFS. And one of the things, as Dr. Giovanni was mentioning, that is so difficult about chronic fatigue syndrome is that, unlike COVID, it also is a post-viral syndrome, but people might have a very mild illness that they can't even put their finger on about when they were sick. And it, there wasn't a global pandemic of, you know, flu or something, where now in this case with long COVID, one of the things that makes it so clear that these symptoms are arising from a post-viral COVID event is that we have millions and millions of people getting sick at the same time. So that kind of emerged as this picture that was hard to ignore. But that that was very, you know, one of the things that made it very difficult in the past to diagnose chronic fatigue syndrome. But yeah, and the doctors, again, that I spoke with said that many, many of their long COVID patients have a diagnosis of ME/CFS.
You write in your article about Tara Gormley, who experiences periods when her heart races very much like our guest Amanda. She gets exhausted quickly. She's unable to concentrate or think clearly. She's a veterinarian who spends most of her days off now resting in the, this is a quote, resting in the dark or going to her many doctor's appointments. Talk about some of her other symptoms, particularly this painful hypersensitivity that she says she has to sound, and the complaints that she shares with others of this brain fog, or what her husband describes as goldfish brain.
Yeah, I think that the brain fog has been probably the most debilitating for Tara, as I mentioned in the article, because she is such a brilliant and driven woman, you know, professional veterinarian, and she will put down her keys or try to say the word stove and can't come up with the words. And this also is a very common symptom among people with long COVID, particularly with people who have these kind of neurological manifestations. And as Amanda, the patient we were speaking with earlier, also mentioned, she had neuropathy and painful erythromelalgia. So all of those kind of point to, and I talk about this in the article as well, that including the POTS, although it does seem like a cardiovascular issue, and there certainly is a cardiovascular component to it, but it is a dysautonomia or a dysregulation of the autonomic nervous system. So it's definitely some attack on the nervous system.
Yeah, let's come back and talk about the autonomic nervous system, because that who knew that a virus would do this to you? We'll talk about exactly what that system is when we return at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about long COVID this morning with two medical experts, Dr. Carl Giovacchini, Assistant Professor of Medicine at Duke University School of Medicine and a Critical Care Specialist at Duke Health, and Dr. Stephanie Sutherland, a neuroscientist and scientific journalist. She wrote an article called The Brain and Long COVID for Scientific American. It's in the March issue. Let's talk a little bit about what you just spoke about, Dr. Sutherland, the autonomic nervous system. Some people may not know exactly what that does. My limited understanding is that it's what allows you to breathe when you're asleep and do many other things as well. Talk about what it does.
Yeah, the autonomic nervous system, really kind of lucky for us, as you said, not only when we're asleep, but when we're awake as well, controls our heartbeat, our breathing, our blood vessel dilation, many of our organ functions, so that we don't have to actually run this body system. It kind of runs itself. So sometimes people will refer to it as the automatic nervous system.
So what is the COVID connection? How has COVID been known to impact that?
Yeah, that's really still how exactly it's impacting is not clear, but it is clear that it is somehow impacting it. And I will say it's not only the autonomic nervous system, but the central nervous system and the rest of the peripheral nervous system, which is outside the brain and spinal cord as well, for other symptoms like pain, like sensitivity, all kinds of neurologically based things like brain fog are probably the COVID is somehow affecting the nervous system inside the brain. And how that happens exactly, there are a number of possibilities. I'll just run through the kind of top view is As we talked about earlier, we know that the SARS-CoV-2 virus can attack the cells that make up blood vessels, and that's throughout the body in different organ systems and including within the nervous system. So that could result in tiny stroke-like events, or also it could just raise an immune reaction within the nervous system or within the brain, which could underlie some of this. Some of the other possibilities that scientists are looking into is that there may be viral persistence, so not a rampant infection. And in fact, research has shown that there isn't rampant infection within the brain. There's not, obvious viral replication inside the brain, but there may be tiny pockets of virus, or maybe not even the whole virus, but just tiny particles of viral proteins or viral genetic material. And then finally, the other possibility is that the body makes antibodies to attack foreign substances like the virus, but those antibodies can also attack our own tissues or our own cells sometimes. And that's called autoimmune, as we see in many autoimmune disorders. And we do know that with people with autoimmune disease or risks for autoimmune disease are also at higher risk for long COVID. So a lot of connections there. And any of those possibilities, they're not mutually exclusive. People may have multiple of those things going on.
Wow. This is pernicious and unpredictable. And that's what makes it all the more scary. Dr. Joe Vicchini, the physician we were trying to get on the program who is local and we couldn't do it. We know that many people lose their ability to taste and smell when they get COVID. This individual says that her taste of sense and smell have come back, but they are now distorted. She lost it completely in mid-2020. Everything now smells like rotting meat, which she describes as disgusting and overpowering. And here's the worst part, especially when she smells her children. Do we understand what's going on here, Dr. Joe Vicchini? Why does COVID do this to our sense of taste and smell?
A full understanding, I would say no. However, there are, again, as Dr. Sutherland was mentioning, a lot of those same inflammatory cascades, the neuroinvasiveness of the SARS-CoV-2 virus plays in here. So those same things, the way that our nervous system interprets those input signals, come through receptors that are probably, especially in the upper airway mucosal system, both directly affected by the virus, the inflammation that happens surrounding the virus, and then also the neuroinvasiveness of the virus in those areas in particular, predisposes to this. So there are many, many patients out there who describe what we refer to as dysgeusia or changes in their taste profile. It's not always what you described, but some patients find all of a sudden things that they loved, like your local Bojangles, absolutely intolerable. The amount of salt is a very, very common thing for patients that they then can't tolerate, which also there are some theories, I think as Amanda was mentioning with her salt intake, that might predispose to additional cardiovascular effects. There might be a drive to reduce your salt intake, and then that might contribute to POTS later on.
I'm taking it, because you're a critical care specialist, that you see some of these people in the course of your practice. Is there a profile that has emerged either in your practice or internationally of people likely to get long COVID from having experienced COVID?
Yeah, it's very interesting. And it's very different, actually, than the critical care COVID population. So I think, like we mentioned earlier, those risk factors that we think of predisposing to severity of disease with your acute COVID infection are not necessarily the things that we associate with risk factors for long COVID. And in fact, a lot like Amanda, many other patients can have almost barely noticeable COVID infections, or perhaps just very, very mild illness, and their later downstream effects are much more significant than what they initially experienced with the acute infection that they had.
When COVID first presented, millions of people around the world were dying. Millions were being put on ventilators because they couldn't breathe. And we immediately associated this with some sort of pulmonary situation, problem. And now, Dr. Sutherland, you say that the most common, persistent, and disabling symptoms of long COVID are neurological. How did it go from being a respiratory problem to a neurological problem?
Yeah, again, the focus, rightly so, in the first months of the pandemic were was on very sick patients who were on respirators, who were acutely very ill. And then as the months went on, and particularly after we had vaccines and people, you know, started to get less sick and fewer people were getting sick, more and more people were emerging with these long COVID symptoms, as Dr. Zabutini said, even after mild illnesses. And again, as I mentioned, some of the possibilities that scientists think might be happening is that there's viral persistence or viral attack on autoimmune type attack on neurological tissues, which could be in the brain, but it could be at any place in the nervous system, in the autonomic nervous system, the peripheral nervous system. And it's just, again, going back to Tara, the patient I talk about in my article and suffering from brain fog, we really just are at the very beginnings in general, even before long COVID, we don't really understand what that is. That's a common symptom for people with chronic fatigue syndrome and some other post-viral illnesses. But really we're not sure what is going on in the brain and the nervous system to cause those cognitive disruptions.
Dr. Giovacchini, we know that HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, can be suppressed by pharmaceuticals to an undetectable level, but the virus itself remains in the body, hiding away, only to be released if you go off those meds. There have been only a few cases in the world that we know about that we assume were cured of HIV. But a lot of the people suffering from long COVID initially caught COVID years ago. And we've talked a little bit about these about viral persistence and viral fragments floating around causing maybe some of these long COVID infections. Could this be the virus operating much the same way that the HIV virus does? Could elements of this be hiding somewhere in your cells waiting to be released at some future date?
So the HIV virus is a special type of virus that works a little bit different than the SARS-CoV-2 virus in terms of its pathogenesis and also persistence. The caveat to that is, I think, a little bit what Dr. Sutherland mentioned. So SARS-CoV-2 is not a virus that in its live form sits around and hides in your body. There are, though, some theories and some ongoing work with some recent publications that have come out that perhaps portions of the virus, non-live particles or proteins of the virus, might persist and cause some inflammatory cascade. And I guess I would say, you know, there's a scientific difference in determining which of these pathways might be the driving pathogenesis, and it might be a little bit of all of them, right? It could be that there is some protein persistence for some amount of time, and then that triggers an inflammatory cascade in some patients that drives an antibody response, and that might be responsible for different types of symptoms that we see in the future. But there is a clear difference too. There's not live virus hiding around dormant for a very long time that's going to reactivate and cause recurrent infection. That's a difference, yeah.
When we were speaking with Amanda earlier, who was on her way to her doctor's appointment, she essentially said there is no treatment for this. You are seeing patients, Dr. Giovacchini. How and because there's so many different symptoms and so many possible different causes, even though the underlying precipitous cause may be COVID, how do you treat it? What do you do for people who are suffering from long COVID?
Yeah, I can tell you that the medical community absolutely hates diagnostic and therapeutic uncertainty. Going back to your other question about a change in focus of what we've focused on in COVID. So there is this acute respiratory problem that happens up front. As there have been mutations, perhaps that's maybe a little bit less severe. And as we've gotten better at preventing acute illness, both with vaccinations and preventative measures, acute treatments, things like Paxlovid that you might have heard of, or acute treatments in the hospital, we're seeing more and more survivors of the acute infection, right? And so we see more and more symptoms and diseases come out of this that we've clustered as long COVID. How do we treat this? We are, I think the medical community is doing its best to define what this is. So again, there's been a big National Institutes of Health initiative in organizing this for a definition, and then diagnostic and therapeutic trials coming out of this. However, until then, as we see patients, we try to lump these symptoms into something that we know, something that is familiar, something like POTS, where we know what that treatment is. We can kind of do our best to manage those symptoms. Things like asthma-like symptoms that come out of, I can treat your symptoms that you might be having from your long COVID as those things. And we have treatments that work symptomatically for that. We just don't yet have a therapeutic thing that might treat quote unquote long COVID as a disease in and of itself. And I would be cautious that there might not be that thing. We might still be treating all of these downstream symptoms, and it might be more of something that we need to prevent happening in the future.
Dr. Sutherland.
Yeah, that's right. I think all of the treatments at this point are just kind of one symptom at a time. I was just going to add that there are clinical trials going on right now of actually of Paxlovid, the antiviral medication for long COVID, with this idea that maybe they could clear if there is any kind of viral persistence or even viral particles. So those trials are ongoing.
As Dr. Giovacchini said a second ago, there is no real comparison between HIV and the virus that causes COVID. But we do know that the vaccines that were developed because of COVID, they were able to do it so quickly because a lot of the research that had been done on HIV. And now you say, yeah, Dr. Sutherland, that one scientist, Troy Torgerson, an immunologist at Allen Institute in Seattle, says COVID has been more carefully studied with better technology in the time we've had it than any other infectious disease ever. And he thinks that some of the things that we're learning here will eventually be applied to other diseases. Like what?
Well, I would just point out Dr. Giovacchini is absolutely right that HIV is a different type of virus, and we don't think that that's what's going on with long COVID. However, there is a post-viral HIV syndrome that does have a lot of parallels with long COVID. And in fact, that body of research has guided researchers and taught us along the way about what's going on with long COVID, particularly in the brain and the nervous system. But as we've been talking about, you know, it's not just HIV. Many people have post-flu, post-viral syndromes. We know that ME/CFS, chronic fatigue syndrome, is now most likely, in most cases, if not everyone, a post-viral syndrome, perhaps from Epstein-Barr virus. And again, that disease has gotten very little attention and very little research. And I just want to point out that many people who would, you know, long COVID and chronic fatigue syndrome and many of these post-viral illnesses affect many more women than men, who often are not believed or gaslit and dismissed. So I think that Dr. Torgerson's point is a really important one, that this is hard to ignore, and that we have to believe that this is real, and all this intense pace of research is hopefully going to help people with those other diseases as well.
Dr. Giovacchini, I have 30 seconds.
Yeah, I would just want to echo what Dr. Sutherland said there. There are many viruses that contribute to post-viral syndromes and present similarly. And I think it's, you know, one silver lining that's come out of this is that a lot of research has come out of dealing, knowing about these post-viral syndromes, believing these patients, and making sure we understand what's going on with the autoimmune cascade.
Very quickly, is there a best line of defense, or is this a crapshoot?
Get vaccinated.
Yeah, prevent the illness in the first place.
Okay.
Yeah, try not to get COVID.
Dr. Coral Giovacchini, Assistant Professor of Medicine at Duke University School of Medicine and a Critical Care Specialist at Duke Health, and Dr. Stephanie Sutherland, a neuroscientist. Her article, The Brain and Long COVID, can be seen in Scientific American.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producer is Gabe Altieri. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.